what he's very good at in classic KGB style is sort of sniffing out weakness, identifying cleavages and divisions of Western societies and trying to exploit them.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host and the creator of Backstory, Dana Lewis. As we speak, President Vladimir Putin has cemented his rule in Russia until 2036. Навсегда, for life. Well, at least until he's 83. The Kremlin managed a referendum vote, which by most observers' accounts was a fraud. Votes rigged, Russians pressured to vote by employers, the illusion of democracy, and the long-term promise of stagnation in Russia for years to come, led by an old KGB spy whose head is in yesterday's Cold War. Okay, so what? In this podcast, we try to answer a little bit of the so what for the West. The answer is disturbing, from American elections to Britain's departure from the EU. Russian influence, jaw-dropping, mind-bending meddling. First, the U.S. Let me read you what John Brennan said earlier this year. He served as chief counterterrorism advisor to U.S. President Barack Obama and was former director of the CIA. Quote, "We are now in a full-blown national security crisis. By trying to prevent the flow of intelligence to Congress, Trump is abetting a Russian covert operation to keep him in office for Moscow's interests, not America's," unquote. Now, could an American president be in the pocket of Russia? The idea sounds ridiculous, so preposterous, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea. But others think so. In news, we like to begin not at the beginning, but with the latest. President Trump recently suggesting Russia kicked out of the G8 should be allowed back in.
Now, I'm not for Russia. I'm for the United States. But as an example, if Vladimir Putin were sitting next to me at a table instead of one of the others, and we were having dinner the other night in Canada, I could say, would you do me a favor? Would you get out of Syria? Would you do me a favor? Would you get out of the Ukraine? Get out of Ukraine. You shouldn't be there. Just come on. Get. Now, I think I'd probably have a good relationship with him. Or I'd be able to talk to him better than if you call somebody on a telephone and talk.
And this while there are reports that Russia's GRU, military intelligence, put out paid bounties in Afghanistan to kill American soldiers. This came from intelligence briefings to Trump. It was leaked to the New York Times and others, but it came from U.S. intelligence. Reaction. Here's Democratic rival for U.S. President Joe Biden.
Truly shocking revelation that if the Times report is true, I emphasize again, is that President Trump, the commander-in-chief of American troops serving in a dangerous theater of war, has known about this for months, according to the Times, and done worse than nothing. Not only has he failed to sanction or impose any kind of consequences on Russia for this egregious violation of international law, Donald Trump has continued his embarrassing campaign of deference and debasing himself before Vladimir Putin. I'm quite frankly outraged by the report. And if I'm elected president, make no mistake about it, Vladimir Putin will be confronted and will impose serious cost on Russia.
Okay, now let's start to roll back from the headlines. And remember, just because you're paranoid, that doesn't mean you're not being followed. You can write a book on the Russia-Trump conspiracy theories. In fact, we need an expert author, journalist, to walk us through it all. And we have one on Backstory. All right, joining me now is Luke Harding. He is a journalist, a writer. He was a correspondent in Moscow around the time that I was a correspondent there. He works for the Guardian newspaper, and he's just written a great book called Shadow State. Luke, thanks for talking. Any doubt in your mind that Donald Trump was pushed into office by the Kremlin?
No, that's the short answer. I think every single American intelligence agency has concluded that Russia, Vladimir Putin, helped Donald Trump win in 2016. He was very much Moscow's candidate. And Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, said the same in his report last year, which actually I have a few problems with, but what was very clear was that Mueller talked about sweeping and systematic interference by Russia. And this was a kind of multi level thing. There was traditional espionage. There were oligarch intermediaries who were buzzing all around the sort of Trump people. And of course, there was a huge social media campaign, which Mueller laid out, involving trolls, sort of professional Russian state bloggers sitting in St. Petersburg pretending to be real Americans when, of course, they weren't. But actually, the corollary of that is that that operation was viewed in Moscow as a terrific success. And I've got no doubt that, that Putin and his kind of team of spies and hackers and sort of troll bots will be back, if they're not back already, in time for November to try and keep Trump in the White House.
Why?
Well, because I think they see him as a pretty damaging guy. I mean, we have to be sort of clear. Putin isn't responsible for all of America's woes. He's not responsible for the turmoil we've seen recently over Black Lives Matter or for Trump's response to the coronavirus epidemic or so on. But what he's very good at in classic KGB style is sort of sniffing out weakness, identifying cleavages and divisions of Western societies and trying to exploit them. And Trump is perfect for that because, to my mind, there's no doubt that America is much reduced on the international stage. It's more America alone than America first. And some of the long-held strategic goals of the KGB throughout the Cold War have come to pass. For example, the US now has pretty lousy relations with Germany, with France, with the European Union, which Trump seems to regard as a kind of enemy, while at the same time fawning over autocrats and despots. So
yeah, I mean, honestly, a lot of your book seems like a ridiculous, far-fetched fiction book. If we didn't already know that it's not, and that we are living a very strange reality right now.
I mean, Dana, that's so true, and. I sort of almost think, you know, why write novels when our reality at the moment is so strange and disturbing and gruesome and containing shocking incidents? And you know, I never planned to write three, or I think I've done four books on Russia now, but it just so happens that Russia's sort of playing this outsized role in international affairs, which is disproportionate to its economy, small, or its real reach. But what it's very good at is it's good at sort of spying, and it's good at these kind of crude, clumsy, bold, we don't care if you catch us operations like the...
Can I ask you about that? Because you obviously, the first part of the book is about Salisbury and the poisoning, yeah, a nerve agent of Sergei Skripal, for people who don't remember. And he was a former GRU spy who then was given over in a prisoner swap. He was released from prison. He settled in the UK. Suddenly, something bad was wiped on his the door of his house, and he almost died along with his daughter. And you paint a picture of a spy service, which, by the way, the GRU is much bigger than the FSB. I mean, this is the one that sows discord, carries out assassinations in Europe. You paint a picture of a GRU that is not exactly... while notorious, is not very effective and bungled that assassination attempt.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think you have to be sort of careful what tone you use when talking about the Skripal assassination, because...
I thought you were going to tell me I better be careful about the tone I use when talking about the GRU.
Well, I mean, that's to do with your own kind of personal risk assessment. But no, my point is merely that. I mean, I compare the GRU, Russian military intelligence, to a sort of lethal but shambling golem. In other words, it's pretty dim, but if it's ginormous fist, if it comes down the street and it smashes your house, then that is a sort of terrible thing. And so certainly the GRU assassins, and we now know there's this top secret unit based in Moscow that's been doing a lot of this stuff.
What's it called?
It's got a rather unpromising name. It's unit, I think, 29155, and it's basically a building in northwest Moscow, and it's a sort of diversionary unit of, we think, maybe 15, 20, 25 officers who, like in the Cold War times, were sort of sent behind enemy lines, and they were hanging out in the French Alps, traveling to Switzerland, shadowing American ambassadors, going to Bulgaria to poison arms dealers, and two of these kind of assassins from this unit flew into Salisbury using fake Russian passports, which said their names were Petrov and Bashirov. And in fact, we now don't know that they were called Mishkin and Shapiga.
Seen very publicly on CCTV video that was released then by the Prime Minister Theresa May at the time.
Well, that's right. And there's a kind of, I mean, when you try and interpret what happened in Salisbury in spring of 2018, I mean, it's clear that they were not very good spies. And in fact, their target survived. And another woman, British woman, Dawn Sturgis, tragically died after picking this stuff up by accident. But at the same time, it is quite effective. I mean, they were carrying a nerve agent. It's the first time that nerve agent has been deployed in Europe since the Second World War in a civilian area. And I think ultimately the message of Salisbury from Moscow to London was a kind of gigantic V sign, a kind of up yours to the British government, to MI6, the British sort of spy service. But ultimately, I think what Salisbury was all about was reminding people inside Moscow that if they, by people I mean the Russian elite and people inside Russian security agencies, that if they blab to the Americans about 2016 and Trump, about Russia's secret operations, that the long hand of Moscow will catch them, maybe some years later, and when they're not looking, it will smash them from behind. And it's a pretty chilling message, and I think quite an effective one.
A former very high-ranking intelligence official on the American side told me technically that doesn't necessarily break one of the unwritten rules, because Skripal was still considered to be one of theirs. But these bounties that were placed on American soldiers in Afghanistan, in intelligence that GRU was paying, you know, cash to kill, that does absolutely cross over red lines in this unwritten code that they have. What would you comment on that?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question, Dana, but I also think that I'm not sure the rules are the rules anymore. I fear we may be in some kind of post-rules age. And in a way, to understand what Russia and Vladimir Putin does, you have to try and figure out how Vladimir Putin thinks. And his thinking is absolutely KGB. It's zero sum. What's bad for the West is good for Russia. And America, as before, as in Soviet times, is the main enemy. And there's a kind of famous quote from Lenin, who said that Moscow's relations with the West were a state of partial war. That's how Putin sees it. He sees himself in a kind of semi-war with America, and Afghanistan is just an extension of that. This is all grudge-driven. He remembers the Soviet humiliation in Afghanistan in the 1980s when the CIA, supplied the Mujahideen with Stinger missiles, and a lot of Soviet soldiers were killed. He thinks, in his conspiratorial way, that America is trying to remove him from power and interferes in Russia's internal affairs and so on. And it's this paranoia sort of sense of victimhood which drives what Russia does internationally. And if they can outsource a murder operation to a few Taliban operatives, that they will do that. That's what the GRU does.
So you believe it has the hallmarks of the GRU. It's believable intelligence, and you believe in the end, you keep saying Putin, you believe that Putin would have to approve something like that, or approve the Salisbury poisoning? Do you believe in both cases? Let's take Afghanistan first. Do you think that he would approve that?
I think that's right. I mean, it's not that Putin makes every single decision in the Russian Federation, big country, 148 million people, 12, 13 time zones. Of course not. But what you have to understand is that both inside the spy agencies and inside government, there is a sort of absolutely Soviet bureaucratic culture where if something difficult needs to be decided, the decision has to go to the top. And when you're talking about extraterritorial assassination of people like Skripal or Alexander Litvinenko killed with a radioactive cup of tea in London in 2006, or a bounty operation to try and rub out American soldiers in Afghanistan, then basically only Putin can authorize that, because if it goes wrong, no one will want to take responsibility. And you just, without being too macabre, you just look at the GRU, and they have a very high turnover of directors. I think the last two or maybe the last three have died very rapidly in mysterious circumstances.
You suggested that the head of the GRU, who was in charge during Salisbury, suddenly came down with an illness and passed away in, what was he, like 62, and that 60-something, and that the feeling was by GRU members that, I mean, that was a message to everybody else. You bungle an operation and you're out. You're out forever.
I mean, the thing is, we have to be careful. You know, we don't know for sure, but one of the people I interview in my book, Shadow State, is Viktor Suvorov, who himself worked for the GRU. He was a star military foreign intelligence guy based in Switzerland who defected back in 1978. And as far as I know, he's the only GRU person who will discuss this sort of secretly. And I talked to him about the death of Igor Korobov, he was called, died, as you say, at the age of 62. And Suvorov said, I said, look, you know, would he have been bumped off? And Suvorov said, well, you know, it's speculation on my part, but everybody inside the GRU will understand 125% that he was murdered. And he just said, they know the nature of this organization. In other words, it's a sort of brotherhood. It's a kind of secret fraternity, but it's also a place where if you mess up, there is no forgiveness.
You know, we talk about Salisbury, we talk about Afghanistan. Those places are far away, but people don't realize that in your book, you also talk about the GRU hacking the DNC and then giving that to WikiLeaks. So, I mean, they've had direct impact on the on Hillary Clinton's campaign, and again, it comes back to Trump being elected.
Yeah, I mean that's right. I mean, the GRU are the heart of this. We know there were two hacking teams, one from the FSB, which is primarily the domestic intelligence service in Russia, the other from GRU, which has a global mandate and traditionally did war and conflict and sabotage, but has got into hacking in the last decade. And certainly American intelligence have been tracking these hackers quite closely, so have the Brits. And actually, you just have to read the Mueller report to see what happened, which was GRU officers, technical people based both at the main building in Moscow and at a kind of tower hired in early 2016, systematically hacked into the DNC with the results that we know. And they also set up this fake persona, Guccifer, that was interacting with very many American journalists and sort of leaking stuff to try and sabotage and blow up the vote. It was pretty effective. And I think what's interesting, I mean, we talked about the spies being rather incompetent, but one thing they're rather good at is that they understand America. They've learned English. Whoever was writing the lines for Guccifer sounded more or less like you do, Dana. I mean, you are
American. Careful, I'm Canadian now. Don't go
Canadian.
Too far.
I'm so sorry. Okay, well,
I get it. No, yeah, they sound North American.
They sound North American in quite a plausible way. And when someone called out Guccifer and said, you're a Russian spy, he wrote back, total fail, !! And I guess my substantial point is there's a sort of cultural imbalance here. You know, America, North America, it's a language the world speaks and understands. It's a culture of Hollywood and movies that people get. Whereas actually Russia, to most people who haven't worked there or don't speak Russian, is a kind of mysterious faraway land. And this has been instrumentalized by Russian spy agencies to their advantage. And you might say that the US was really taken for a ride by foreigners it didn't understand 4 years ago.
We talk about the Steele dossier on Trump a little bit, and I'm surprised you went back to that because a lot of people have raised questions about it. He is a former British spy who put together a dossier with a number of different sources that you talk about at length in the book, not who the sources are, but you talk about how solid his sources may be. And essentially, the allegation is that there is compromise. The Russians knew that Donald Trump did something in a hotel room with a couple of prostitutes, and that is one of the collars that they have on the on the highest office in the land in America right now. And in your book, you suggest that it's still considered, or at least Steele thinks, that it was never proven wrong despite Trump's denials, and it's still about 80 to 90% true.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, because, you know, I mean, Trump, as we know, is not a man with a great relationship with the truth, and because he denies something repeatedly and attacks whoever, that doesn't actually make something inaccurate.
So it wasn't discredited.
Well, so I haven't actually talked to anyone who knows Russia, who either lived there or worked there, as you and I did as correspondents, or who worked for, obviously talked to various people in foreign intelligence services, who don't think that the FSB has a file on Donald Trump, which, if it's in paper form, is bigger than your house and my house put together. I mean, Trump first visited Soviet Moscow back in 1987, where there's no doubt the KGB spied on him, and there were discussions about building a Trump Tower and so on. And Czech intelligence was spying on him and his then wife, Czechoslovakia.
And we know, living in Russia, that's routine. If you are a foreigner, especially a high profile one like Donald Trump, or you're a journalist or you're a businessman, if you go to a hotel room or you go out somewhere, you are most likely going to be videotaped and recorded somewhere.
Yeah, and if you stay in the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Moscow, where President Obama stayed, and you are a very well-known American businessman, then everything will be recorded anyway. I mean, it's just what the FSB does. It's what the KGB did. Mm-hmm. And also, I know from personal experience. I mean, I spent 4 years in Moscow as a guidance correspondent from 2007 to 2011. And we had a series of really spooky, nasty break-ins by the FSB into our apartments, where they moved stuff around and they left stupid clues that anybody could find, open windows. And I talked to the British Embassy and I said, look, what's going on? And they said, well, confidentially, yeah, it's the FSB. They treat the Americans in the same way, diplomats, the Brits as well. Yeah.
And I said, when I was there, an American diplomat told me how on a regular basis he used to come home and there would be something left in the toilet, or there would be a cigarette burning in the ashtray, and the message being, you know, we are on you, we are watching you all the time.
We're watching you all the time. And they said, look, your apartment is bugged. And I said, well, what about the bedroom? And they said, yeah, that's also bugged. And then I said, look, well, you know, might Her Majesty's government do something about this? And they said, sorry, old chap. You know, have a cup of tea and a biscuit, you know, because basically, first of all, I never worked for them. And secondly, it would be counterproductive because the FSB would break in again anyway and just reinstall the bugs. So if they bothered with you and your friends and me, imagine what they will do with people who've got real intelligence value like Trump. So ultimately, Trump says it's not true, but he's made multiple visits to Moscow. There'll be a very large file. There'll be a psychological profile of him, of his weaknesses, of a readout of his phone calls and so on. And I mean, Trump can deny it, but it's there.
Do you believe Steele? Do you believe the dossier?
I mean, with a few caveats, yeah. I mean, I don't think the dossier is immaculate. It was raw intelligence produced at speed. But I think the basic premise, the basic pillar that the Russians wanted Donald Trump to win and have been cultivating for some time is true. And I think the compromat is there's definitely compromat, whether it's two prostitutes or three or something else. It's the best explanation for why Trump behaves the way he does with Putin. And he's...
Doesn't it amaze you, to jump in here, though, but you have every meeting being recorded and constant surveillance. And yet when the two presidents meet, you have these tremendous gaps, and where President Trump went to great lengths that the meetings with Putin were not transcribed or recorded.
Yeah, and we also have the latest report from Carl Bernstein with CNN saying that his understanding is that Trump is unbelievably slavish, fawning before Putin whenever they speak on the phone, while at the same time being demeaning and pretty awful to Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, to Theresa May when she was British Prime Minister, and so on. And clearly, he doesn't want this out. And I suspect if we ever get to see the transcripts of their conversations, that actually it won't be Vladimir Putin saying, you know, Donald, do what we say, or we'll release the tape. It's Putin using silky KGB flattery, saying, Donald, I am your true friend. You're beset by enemies, by fake news, by the media, by people who hate you, but I recognize your greatness and I will stick loyally with you to the end. And this seems incredibly crude, but it seems to work with Trump. It seems to work with Trump. And actually, any self-respecting foreign dictator is able to manipulate him.
Page 301. I'm going to read your book now. Sorry, I'm stealing your book. Quid pro quo chapter. As Trump geared up for the 2020 election, his relationship with Putin was still not fully explained. Russia didn't invent Trump or the isolationist forces he represented, but it certainly encouraged him that Putin had leverage of some kind over Trump seemed indisputable. So this isolationist force he represented, then you start building a bridge between what Putin did in America in the election and with Trump to the Brexit vote in Britain and the election victory of Boris Johnson, which was linked, you make the case.
Yeah, there were two major espionage operations in 2016. One was Trump, which we've talked about, and the other was actually supporting the Brexit side in the EU referendum that we had here. Now, it's pretty clear that especially after 2014 in the war in Ukraine, when the European Union imposed sanctions on Russia, that Putin was extremely keen to do anything that would damage the EU. Brexit was a kind of ideal vehicle for that. And as we've seen, it's estranged London from Paris and Berlin. It's reduced, diminished the UK. It's not great for our economy or international reputation and so on. And what I try and lay out in Shadow State are the interactions between Russian spies based at the Russian embassy in London and key people from the Leave EU campaign, such as Aaron Banks, Bristol businessman, his sidekick Andy Wigmore, and so on. And this is important because British politics is not the same sums of money as in North American politics. And Banks gave almost £9 million to the Leave campaign. It's the biggest donation in British political history. And there's been a big question mark about where he got that money from. Yeah. He has a Russian wife. We now know he visited the Russian ambassador on multiple occasions in the run-up to the vote. He was offered gold deals by a friendly Russian tycoon from Siberia, then a diamond deal, then another gold deal.
Okay, so you're not the first person to raise any of these question marks. I mean, you do it very eloquently, but there was an all-party investigation here. The report, as we speak, so people don't understand that this is some kind of historical loose end. I mean, this is an ongoing discussion in the UK about what influence the Russians may have had over the Brexit campaign. And that report has been locked up in number 10 Downing Street. Prime Minister Boris Johnson wants to keep it secret. Why?
Well, we don't entirely know because he basically stuffed the report down his sock in October of last year. And as you say, it's kind of refused to publish it ever since. But I think I'm not expecting a kind of huge smoking gun, by the way, from this report, but I suspect it's a sort of serious and discursive document. It's about 50 pages long, apparently, with a secret annex, which lays out some of the ways in which Russia has tried to intervene in British politics.
And likely compromise Trump.
Well, yeah, and that's part of it, is that this is actually a story I kind of broke for The Guardian last week, but Christopher Steele was one of a group of expert witnesses invited to give evidence. And he produced a sort of 7-page strategic overview memo, which I've read. It's actually a very good document. One accusation he makes is that the British government of Theresa May, who was prime minister at the time, and Johnson, who was the British foreign secretary, were basically warned. They were told in late 2016 that the Russians most probably had leverage over Donald Trump. And instead of investigating or getting their best spies to try and chase this down and asking their secret sources in Moscow, they threw a blanket over it, according to Steele, because they were terrified of Trump, basically, knowing what a notoriously volatile guy he is. But they were also afraid that if they investigated him, this might jeopardize the sort of post-Brexit trade deal between the US and the UK. And Steele's allegation, if you like, is that they put party politics before British national security. And that's a pretty grave claim.
I want to just ask you about this referendum. Obviously, we now have a president in Russia who's going to be there potentially, if he chooses to be, till 2036, till he's 83 years old, I think, President Putin. What does it matter, first of all, for Russia? And a lot of people are saying it's stagnation, and it's probably not very good news.
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of two broad aspects of this. One is it's a disaster for Russia because Putin strikes me as tarred. And I'm not even sure he necessarily wants to go on until he's 83, but essentially it's a soft dictatorship, if you like. Real genuine political opposition was extinguished long ago. And he, as of today, is effectively kind of president for life. I mean, he's going to out Brezhnev and out Stalin. I think he doesn't out Ivan the Terrible. I think Ivan the Terrible
There's somebody that he doesn't outlast. Thank you, Luke.
But the point is that it's going to be more of the same. It's going to be this kind of phony political landscape. It's going to be a deeply corrupt, often sort of brutally repressive regime. So that's not great for ordinary Russians.
And then for the West.
And for the West, it means that we're going to have more of these misadventures that we've seen in the US, UK, and across Europe over the next few years, because Putin and Putin's brain is still there. And as we discussed, he sees the West as the enemy and is doing everything in his power to undermine and subvert it. So we're going to get more exotic murders down the road. We're going to get more election interference, not just in November, but beyond. Clandestine support for far-right, xenophobic, populist parties, and more kind of social media stuff, which never really kind of let up. So it's a pretty depressing day for anyone who believes, if it's possible to still believe in democracy and transparency, and just in the idea that government should change, that it's a good thing that you change your leaders from time to time.
Yeah, I covered him in the year 2000 on the night where everybody thought the computers were going to crash on Y2K, as suddenly we had this surprise announcement by Boris Yeltsin. I cannot believe we're talking about it 20 years later. And we're going to be talking about President Putin for a long time. Luke Harding, great journalist, and the book Shadow State. I think if you don't know about President Putin, you will certainly know more about him after reading it. And I think it also it ties how it has affected the West, whether it be the United Kingdom or America. It's a great book. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Daniel. Really, real pleasure to talk to you. Thanks very much.
And now let me take you to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and introduce you to Colin Clark. He is a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center, a resource and forum for research, analysis, strategic dialogue related to global security issues and emerging threats. Colin, first
Thanks
of all,
for having me.
If I can ask you, a few national security analysts, you wrote, were surprised by recent allegations of Russian bounty payments to the Taliban insurgents who killed Americans. You're saying very few were surprised?
Yeah, I don't think many were surprised that this is something the Russians are capable of. I mean, this is the same country that sent agents into the UK to poison Litvinenko, that has conducted assassinations in Germany. So, I don't think the Russians are constrained in any way by international law or operate within the kind of confines of contemporary international relations. This is well within their wheelhouse to do so. The main surprise has been the fact that this made it into the presidential daily brief, yet nothing was done about it. That's where the surprise is, not that the Russians are capable of this.
And is there generally in the sort of intelligence community and analysts dismay that President Trump has kind of passed this over now as saying, well, it wasn't really substantiated intelligence. There was some debate, and therefore we're not going to take any action.
Yeah, there's dismay. That's probably an understatement. It's just yet another example of the president being soft on Russia. It seems like Putin is able to act with impunity, that he's treated with kid gloves while other world leaders, I mean, more often than not, you hear Trump taking a hard line on Angela Merkel and other allies, yet he talks about Putin and Kim Jong-un glowingly. So it's just a bit bizarre. And here, let me just be clear, we're talking about very, very serious allegations. We're talking about bounty payments on U.S. soldiers. I don't think it gets any more serious than that.
I know that General Petraeus, the former head of the CIA, has come out and he said, you know, if true, and it has certainly been leaked far and wide for the New York Times, for the Washington Post and more, and then basically confirmed by the White House that it was in some written briefings, whether Trump read them or not. But if true, then this is not normal statecraft. This breaks all of the written rules, the unwritten rules. And he said that it should even go to NATO because it was just not American troops, it was also British troops, and it should go to NATO for possible action. It is that serious.
Yeah, it's that serious. But again, let me just say, it is well outside the bounds of international law. But this isn't the first time the Russians are doing this. Poisoning people on British soil, as they've done with impunity, and conducting assassination campaigns in Europe, right? We know who Putin is. He reminds us very frequently. When is the West, the United States, NATO, et cetera, going to get serious about pushing back against what the Russians are doing? When Putin
I guess some people would make an argument that the killing of Litvinenko, who was a former member of the intelligence service in Russia, or the poisoning in Salisbury, which was somebody who had left the GRU and had worked for Russia and was considered to be a traitor. That's a lot different than targeting foreign nationals and Americans in Afghanistan.
Well, it's also being done on British soil, right? This isn't happening in
you absolutely.
Know, and it's not like it could be contained, as we saw, just to, the targets themselves. There's second order effects. But it's, again, it's all part and parcel of this, Russian tactics to push the envelope and to take as much as we'll give them. And that's in the cyber domain. It's in the use of mercenaries like the Wagner Group in the Middle East and in Africa. It's in the blatant use of disinformation to meddle in elections all over the world. So when Putin smells weakness, he becomes more aggressive. It's like, blood in the water for a shark. And so, constantly reassuring him and saying, well, I believe him. He told me that I didn't do it. Oh, okay. It's just baffling to me. It almost feels like we're living in an alternative universe.
It baffles a lot of people. And, before I talk to you, we played a soundbite of President Trump speaking on board of Air Force One, where he said essentially that Putin should be back in the G8, because then he could talk to him. He could say, hey, Vladimir, get out of Ukraine and get out of Syria, and that it would be better to have that dialogue with him.
Yeah, it sounds like a great strategy. Just ask him to leave. I'm sure it'll work. In all seriousness, every time the Russians sense a power vacuum or an opportunity, they seize it, right? We've seen it in Syria. We've seen it in Libya. We've seen it in Ukraine, Crimea. The list goes on and on. One wonder, at what point will we craft a coherent strategy to deal with Russia?
You have written quite a bit about Syria, and the Russians we know are there and have been for a long time. Libya, they've moved MiG fighters in there and they are interfering in Libya. But one of the interesting things that you're now writing about is the fact that white supremacist training has taken place in Russia in St. Petersburg. Do I have that right?
Indeed. That was part of the designation of the RIM, the Russian Imperial Movement. There was training camps in St. Petersburg where Scandinavians and Germans were being allowed to train violent white supremacists and then go back into Europe. We know that the leader of a neo-Nazi group called The Base, who's an American, Ronaldo Nazaro, also goes by the name Norman Spear, is alleged to be living in St. Petersburg. And that's only what we know about. My gut instinct tells me that the Russians are behind a lot more of fueling violent white supremacy at a transnational level. And I think with these types of things, there's always a lag effect, right? They're laying the groundwork now, and we're only likely to see, what we're likely to see is some real serious issues in the future going forward, many of which, my guess is, will be have tied in some way to Russia, although they're operating in the shadows.
I don't get why a country that lost 30 million people to the Nazis in World War II would now be training Nazi groups in St. Petersburg.
Maybe the same reason why, you know, British protesters marching to protect the Winston Churchill statue would give Nazi salutes. People don't have a sense of history, and it serves their current cause. There's been a melding of ideologies. We see it in this country. There's a kind of blurring of the lines all across the board. And so it's quite myopic, I agree, especially when you consider about the potential for blowback. But at the same time, it serves an immediate need.
And the need is to what? Disrupt the West and send those people into the U.S. and into Britain and into Western Europe to do what?
Absolutely, to disrupt the West, yeah, to cause and sow havoc and chaos, which they've been doing. And as the West becomes more preoccupied with combating violent white supremacy, there's less time to keep an eye on what the Russians are doing in their near abroad and elsewhere. Look, we have finite resources in the United States here. We're being crippled by COVID. The economy is bottoming out. And so there's only so many things we can deal with at once. And I think as we are consumed domestically and internally, that opens up opportunities for a whole range of adversaries, chief among them Russia.
And as an American, a lot of Americans don't watch geopolitical events too much. They're consumed with all of the things that you mentioned, including a pandemic at home. What does Russia get out of this? I mean, why are they trying to destabilize America?
Well, I think many people don't realize that, revenge could be a significant component of this. Putin has gone on record to say that the collapse of the Soviet Union is one of the greatest tragedies of his lifetime. If you look back to how the United States acted after the Cold War, in many ways, some would argue that we rubbed it in Russia's face when we could have been a bit more helpful. Think back to what the 1990s were like in Russia. It was the Wild West. It was a free-for-all. And so the Russians haven't forgotten that. We've pushed NATO up to their doorstep. And now the tables are turned a little bit where the Russians are able to kind of really take some actions on the cheap, I would say, as well. This is a great return on investment for them. Disinformation campaigns and the amount of instability that's caused in the United States and in Europe, they're having a field day with this, and it's easy to do.
Will you comment on the referendum result? I don't think anybody was surprised, and we knew that the Kremlin was going to put the fix in no matter what. But, I mean, here you have Putin potentially in the Kremlin until 2036 if he decides to stay.
Yeah, I mean, again, no surprise that he's kind of gaining control and consolidating power within Russia. What it does signify is that, the U.S.-Russian relationship will continue to be quite rocky if he's at the helm. There's a lot of talk about Putin is 10 feet tall and he's playing conventional chess. That might be going a bit too far for me. I call it the kitchen sink approach. I think the Russians do a lot of stuff. They throw a lot of stuff against the wall. And then some of it sticks. They figure out what sticks, and then they do more of that. We tend to focus on that stuff. We don't focus on a lot of things that don't work. And I still think when push comes to shove, in a conventional military battle, the United States is still the world's, predominant superpower. But that's not the way wars are fought in 2020. Wars are now being fought through disinformation, through the use of mercenaries, through cyber attacks. And clearly, Russia has figured that that's an asymmetric advantage that they've enjoyed and will continue to hone those skills.
Colin Clark at the Soufan Center. Thanks, Colin. I think you're going to have lots to write about because Putin's not going anywhere.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
And that's our backstory on Russia, the shadow state. By the way, many think Russia pushed hard on this referendum because the Kremlin fears social unrest as early as this fall in Russia. People unhappy with COVID-19 and a lack of government support, failing businesses, rising inflation, and oil prices have tanked. Publicly, the Kremlin says Putin is loved. Just look at his support in the referendum, which others say was a fraud. The truth has a way of bubbling up, even in Russia. I'm Dana Lewis, and please, don't just listen to Backstory once.
but subscribe, and we're trying to grow our listeners. If you share our links, that's awesome. Thanks, and talk soon.